And first this morning, Rod Oram, our business commentator. Very good morning.
Good morning, Catherine.
Your take on the budget then, it was pretty high level, Rod, and understandable in the circumstances, perhaps. But what did you make of what you saw on Thursday?
I'll just deal with some broad themes. The first one is that all the recovery programs in there are good. So, for example, the extension of the one on wage subsidies for those companies which have been hit by a higher loss of revenues, that threshold is up to now 50%, and that subsidy would last longer, obviously applies to sectors such as tourism, and that's very appropriate. Secondly, the debt levels are very manageable. So at the peak of debt, some years from now, that will be around about 50% of GDP. And that is where the UK started going into this crisis, whereas the US started at 90%, and some countries like Italy have been well over 100%. So that debt is very, very manageable. But the real problem with the budget was there is a sort of no future direction in it. And I appreciate the government has been very busy with dealing with the pandemic itself, but it would have been possible to build in some direction on that. And I'll give you, and I'll come back to how that might be done, but I'll give you two cases in point. The first one is there is negligible money in the budget to stimulate e-commerce and digitization of business processes and models, which are the two biggest key learnings out of the COVID crisis. So, for example, New Zealand Trade and Enterprise got another $10 million to further the work that it's doing on that. And of course, it has actually stepped up very significantly. That's been a big new strategic thrust for it. And I would argue that $10 million is nowhere near enough. Whereas the government is preparing to write off $80 million of sunk costs in unsuccessful projects that companies can identify, hoping that that might stimulate innovation of another kind. So I think that there's it from an innovation point of view, the budget is very disappointing. But let me give you a second example. There was $1.1 billion in the budget to create 11,000 jobs to pull up weeds, kill pests, and root up wilding pines. But that's only manicuring the mess we've made of the environment. It doesn't deal with the systemic issues. There's nothing memorable or long-lasting about that work. All three of those adverse impacts will spring back as soon as the effort ceases. By comparison, that money is not being spent on anything with a durable benefit, like we've seen, for example, in some aspects of Depression-era programs, you know, back in the 30s. In contrast, Greenpeace New Zealand was advocating a $1 billion fund to help farming switch to regenerative agricultural processes. And that $1 billion would have been a very big systemic, long-lasting improvement to our environmental performance. But crucially, it would be dealing with the systemic issues which are causing that environmental damage in the first place. So what do you want? $1 billion to temporarily reduce weeds, pests and wilding pines, or $1 billion to start shifting the agricultural sector? So that's the sort of problem that I think is in the budget. And if there is time, I could offer you some thoughts on how those sorts of issues could have been built into this budget at this preliminary stage, but maybe you don't have time for that now.
No, please do, because I've just actually recorded an interview with Joseph Stiglitz that we're going to play shortly, talking about just this, the missed opportunities of the previous crises, where there was massive injections of public funds into often private companies. And he's talking specifically about the missed opportunities that were then and that they shouldn't be missed again. He's joining a welter of voices around the world saying the same thing. If you've got to spend this much money on stimulus, make sure it shifts the dial.
Yeah, and I think the best analysis of this I've seen around is by Vivid Economics in the UK, and they've been very influential here. So, for example, they were a consultant to and a modeler for our Productivity Commission's report in 2018 on our transition to a low emissions economy. And so what they've been clocking from stimulus packages around the world, but that at best only about 11% of the money starts to deal with these forward-looking issues. That 11% has come from a handful of countries, such as Spain, the United Kingdom, and France. France is the best. So more than 50% of its stimulus package is focused this way. The US is the worst, where 100% of its stimulus package is the complete opposite. In fact, some of it is very negative, such as bailing out oil and gas producers. But then Vivid goes on to make some very important points. The first one is that these bailouts can drive medium-term sustainability goals while still addressing short-term financial need. And the government should pursue this to maximize the value of taxpayer money. But the flip side of that is that just dealing with recovery of existing systems now is putting such a financial burden on governments that will greatly reduce the resources they have to then make this secondary transition to, for example, a low emissions economy. And it then goes on to make a whole bunch of really interesting suggestions about how those policies can work together. But perhaps I'll leave it at that for now.
What were some of the other areas where you would see it as disappointing? You alluded to the short-term work on nature, which does the straight-out job of providing jobs, perhaps, without, as you say, necessarily dealing to the underlying systemic issues. But did you also mention e-commerce and the digital opportunities?
Yes,
that, if anything, have been sort of fast-tracked in
Absolutely.
Many instances out of necessity?
Yeah. So now this is a major new thrust from New Zealand Trade and Enterprise responding to business needs. And I think an extra $10 million for New Zealand Trade and Enterprise in this field is paltry. But it shouldn't just be for New Zealand Trade and Enterprise, because they're dealing with a highly targeted group of exporters. And this is an enormous transition that needs to be across the whole economy. But I'll give you another example. There is money for, as memory serves, insulating another 9,000 houses, but there's something like 500,000 houses in New Zealand which are substandard from an insulation point of view. We know exactly the very fast payback for government on that in terms of reduced healthcare costs and the rest, and of course all the benefits of lower heating costs and better health for the people in those houses. So why not train up 11,000 people to go and insulate those houses rather than employ 11,000 people to pull up weeds and root up wilding pines? Once you put that insulation in the house, it's permanent. But once you stop pulling up the pines and pulling up the weeds, they'll come back. I mean, that's, to me, the ultimate short-termism.
Is there still room? I think we had this conversation just immediately after the budget, actually, with some of those advocating for these sorts of programs. Is there still room to do it? Obviously, everything was so rushed here. But when you look at what the Green Building Council was saying about retrofitting commercial buildings, or even the opportunity posed by building several thousand new state houses to build them differently, to put them together with the training and apprenticeship programs that you're also spending $1 billion on, and use some of the absolute most up-to-date insulation techniques, for example. Is there still time to make those things happen, or will they be victims to the need for speed?
I think they will continue to be victims of short-termism and speed. Obviously, I'm not arguing that the budget should have had, you know, massive, fully articulated programs identified of the nature I'm talking about. But there should have been in the budget the start of some framework that begins that transition. As I say, the work of Vivid and looking at, say, the way that Spain, the UK and France are responding on this shows us how that can be done. And I suppose my concern is that we've swapped one crisis for another. Climate change has just disappeared off the agenda because we're so focused on COVID-19. Yes, absolutely, to focusing on COVID-19. And we've done a good job on that, a very good job on that. But I just think that this not only sends all the wrong signals, but my concern is that the government has been so preoccupied on COVID-19, it's not taking a bigger view on this. And I'd actually add one other point on this. From a journalist point of view, one of the great difficulties of COVID-19 is the government has been very difficult to get hold of. I have really struggled to get through, and indeed have failed to get through to the finance minister's office or the PM's office and get any kind of response on simple questions like what's the basic architecture here of the relationship between government and business. Furthermore, I was having a conversation with the chief executive of one government agency that's very involved in business, and the very clear message was that person's instructions were only to talk positively about the economy. So some quite interesting things came up that which would have been very constructive were off the record. And I just think that this is a complete non-starter, that there is this apparent suppression of discussion of a wider nature. So to me, there is something odd going on here from the government's point of view. And it's been immensely frustrating through these last 2 months that I, as a journalist, have completely failed to break through that.
Well, you're not the only one. And what we have seen is an extraordinary level of management of the message. We got it put in bold terms, didn't we, in that email that was sent out accompanying the release of the OIA document saying, do not put any ministers up to discuss this. We don't have to. We can dismiss. We have all experienced what it's been like to try and get a particular minister on their portfolio, frankly, from our perspective, even if their portfolio is health, to speak on matters, and a very small numbers put forward. So, what you're seeing is, I suppose, a part, one could argue, of an emergency messaging response initially, but now something that is at risk of becoming concerning.
Yes, absolutely. Because I think we are still have enough social cohesion and maturity and intelligence to be able to have a fully fledged conversation about what we're trying to do. I just don't think that's happening. And again, I am sympathetic to the government. It's been very busy. I absolutely understand that. But at some point, we are going to have to be able to talk about not only the opportunities, but what's holding us back, and be able to get some of these astonishingly important subjects back on the table. I mean, it's an old line, but I'm going to retail it anyway. Fine, a vaccine for COVID-19, but there ain't no vaccine for climate crisis. We've actually got to get on and make some really big changes. And of course, those in turn build up all kinds of resilience that then help us better economically and socially deal with further pandemics, of which we can only assume there will be more.
It's interesting, 11 o'clock news bulletin, National crying foul over a no-show by Treasury at today's Epidemic Response Committee. The Treasury Secretary and the Deputy Secretary were both due to appear. An hour beforehand, there was advice that the Secretary was unwell, which may well be the case, and that the Deputy Secretary was on leave, which perhaps ought to have been sorted before there was an hour to go. So there's an agitation out there. We should put it in the wider context, though, Rod, that's been going on for a long time, even things journalists, covering crime and courts and social issues can no longer speak to their local police officer. This predates the current situation, but has been perhaps particularly acute for originally justifiable reasons, but becoming less so?
Absolutely. It's a plea only to try to engage on these issues.
All right. Now, takeovers. What's happening with the MetLife Care court case that is happening at the moment? A scrap over a possible acquisition?
The rest home operator, one of the large ones here, had received a takeover offer from EQT, a Swedish private equity fund, before the COVID crisis that valued it at $7 a share for $1.5 billion. EQT has since pulled the plug on that, arguing that because of COVID, there's a clause in the contract about material adverse change in MetLife's circumstances justifies cancelling the takeover offer. And EQT has made some estimates about how much the value of MetLife Care has fallen or will fall because of COVID, and indeed how much its profits will fall. In response, MetLife Care has said that on one hand, it's too early to predict what those how those numbers are going to work out. But very crucially, the material adverse conditions clause is not triggered by a change in general economic conditions. It's only triggered by the performance of the company itself. And indeed, in this case, of course, MetLife Care is arguing that it was government action, i.e. the lockdown, which has potentially caused some impact on its finances that are yet to be fully understood, worked out and documented. So I think that, I'm not trying to second guess the court case, but I think it is an important one because it's most likely to hinge at least in part on that question of to what extent the impact on MetLife Care can be calculated at this stage, but more importantly, what is the should that material adverse conditions clause be triggered or not be triggered because this was a government action?
That is going to be fascinating, and one can see flow-on effects in all sorts of situations. We were talking this morning about the transmission gully hold-ups, the latest hold-ups. That's a slightly different argument. That's about whether, it's about a lot of things we understand, although, again, no one will front to explain. But, you know, there are force majeure clauses and contracts as well, talking about acts of God. And, you know, a pandemic might be described as an act of God, but as a lockdown, is it being told that you can't go to work? There's going to be all sorts of interesting cases and negotiations to emerge out of this.
There's a bigger theme here that all sorts of people in all sorts of ways will be using the COVID crisis for their own purposes. On Transmission Gully, that's always been a very problematic project. Obviously, it's going to be beneficial to the companies involved in it, an Australian company and a New Zealand company, that, you know, if they succeed in dissolving the partnership, or at least being able to walk away from their obligations. So it'll be interesting to see how the merits of that work out. But I think that basic theme of watching very carefully and closely and questioning why people do what they do in this period of extraordinary turmoil and change, I think is a very important principle.
There'll be a lot of busy lawyers, that's for sure. Now, just finally, New Zealand shareholders, $2 billion they've put up for rights issues on the NZX.
This is a common theme around the world where share markets have been very buoyant. I and others would argue that they are totally disconnected from economic reality. there's all sorts of explanations for that that I won't go into right now. But the long and the short of it is companies have been raising more funds through rights issues from their shareholders. And so in New Zealand, that started with Kathmandu on the 1st of April, $384 million. Z Energy is the latest at $350 million. And the total is well over $2 billion. Now, the issue here is that each of the seven companies have quite different prospects. So, for example, Auckland International Airport, which has raised the most money, $1.2 billion, obviously has a future of some kind. It will take some time to work it through. But more complicated is Vista, that makes software for cinemas. We're not quite sure how cinema bookings are going to be going, but it's raised $65 million. But there are three companies in there. Moa Group, which of course is a beer brewer, but since last year it made a big diversification into hospitality by buying up some restaurants and bars. It's raised $5.2 million. And then there are two commercial property companies, one Investor, which invest in large format retail properties, raising raising $100 million, which is a substantial proportion of its overall value. And Augusta Capital, which manages office, retail, and industrial properties. In Augusta's case, it was heading for a takeover, but on March the 25th, the Australian company that was going to pay $180 million for it cancelled the transaction. So I think it's very much that buyers or shareholders should beware. The outlook for those commercial property companies is very difficult, given especially if they've got retail exposure, and that would apply to Moa too. Whereas the likes of Zed and Auckland Airport, one could feel a lot more confident about their long-term outlook. Kathmandu would also have a huge overhang on its retail outlets, although it's obviously got opportunity to develop its e-commerce side as well. So I just think that it's really important here that shareholders have a very good think about what sort of company is asking them for money, and realistically, what are the big unknowns about that company's outlook before they give very serious consideration to that before they commit more money to those companies in a rights issue.
It really is an interesting observation at the moment, just like every market trying to work out what value is and realistically what prospects are, with so many unknowns. And yet at the same time, we need commerce, we need the economy to keep moving. It's a challenging one, isn't it?
It is.
Rod Oram, business commentator, thank you.